You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Thank you, Susanna Duffy. It's just gone 9 a.m. and you're now listening to Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence. Today's show is brought to you from the stolen lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung and the Wadawurrung peoples of the Kulin Nations. I acknowledge sovereignty was never ceded. I acknowledge the elders, past, present, and emerging, and extend that respects to any First Nations listeners tuning in today. This show supports First Nations people in their struggle for self-determination, land back, sovereignty, restitution, and treaty.
Slums in some metropolitan centers are coming down, condemned by forward-looking civic governments. Down are coming the bad living conditions that produce bad citizens.
The practical uses of asbestos are very numerous. At least 18,000 articles are made of it.
In the spring, the nature-loving Australian goes bush.
The wife washes and the dishes dry themselves.
Amy is a serial pest.
Cities within cities, scientifically planned and built, where a man and his family with a small income can live with comfort and dignity as investments in democracy.
Tip and straight to your ears is me, Amy. My pronouns are she, her, and they, them. That's right, you are listening to Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence. What's this show all about? Well, it's about challenging the little boxes we find ourselves in society. Do you want to see every human being with the ability to live in the security of having a home, community, clean air, water, and secure resources? Well, that's not what our society is all about. It's about dividing people into little boxes. It's about dividing people into little boxes. Whether it's our alienated communities and homes, or about how a man or a woman should behave. Are those LGBT people getting too loud? Well, let's promote the idea of the acceptable LGBT plus people. You know, the ones that tone it down and buy property and work for the banks or the cops. Do you want our green spaces to become more useful to feeding us, nourishing our spirits, and restoring Indigenous ecologies that were destroyed by the colonial capitalist project that is Australia? Well then, this show is an attempt to create a space for people like myself interested in those things. How do we get there? Well, you got to get your hands dirty. Start chatting to your neighbours, get involved in your local community struggles, and movement building. If someone tells you you're not doing enough, tell them to get lost. That's right, Cassie. What we need is numbers and societal change. So if you have to go through drive-through window to feed yourself, or if you need to buy food wrapped in plastic, that's okay, because the issues of our time have been made into issues of personal responsibility, which is one of the reasons we are going nowhere. You are absolutely right, Cassie. It's time to get back on track with the rest of the show. So, I've been taking some self-care time this month, and seeing as it is the 50th anniversary, I'm playing some segments from other 3CR shows that discuss sovereign nations that are doing things different, in a celebration of the diversity of our 3CR programming. Last episode's show was on Laos and Cuba, and today's episode is on the Democratic Federation of North Syria, otherwise known as Rojava. The segment I'm playing is one of the shows that doesn't run anymore but played a part in inspiring this show you're listening to now, which was the SUA show, which stands for Squatters and Unwaged Airwaves. They did an amazing segment on November 16th, 2018 on Rojava. It was around that time I was calling myself an anarcho-communist for the first time, and Rojava was a really exciting example for me of these principles being put in place. Any country practicing a left-wing form of government is warred upon by the rest of the globe because their success is a direct threat to capitalism, colonialism, and imperialism. So places like Rojava are beacons of community, growing food and medicine, governance from the bottom up, the things our society here in so-called Australia could learn a lot from. But before we get to that segment, let's have a little break and then head into cool stuff that we don't use, but probably should.
The revolution in Rojava is a beacon of hope for the world, putting direct democracy and feminism into practice on a broad scale. This radical attempt at social transformation now faces huge challenges, including daily attacks by the Turkish military with little outside recognition or aid. Show your support for Rojava by joining Northeast Syria Solidarity, or NESS, and help ensure the survival of this inspiring experiment in social change. NESS sends aid, raises awareness, and builds solidarity. Get involved at www.nesssolidarity.org.au. NESS is a 3CR supporter.
Kefirs are Palestinian scarves, and they're a symbol of support for justice for the Palestinian people. From the traditional black and white kefir to an array of modern designs, explore the range and order online or drop by 3CR during business hours. Wear your support for the rights of Palestinians. Go to kefirs.org.au, that's kefirs.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
Hello, this is the promised cool stuff segment following up from open source segment 2 episodes ago. So, do you hate manufactured obsolescence? That's the deliberate failure of something like a computer, phone, vehicle, or appliance after a certain number of years, uses, or even a shorter amount of time. Our computers and phones, which are also computers, by the way, in case you didn't know that our phones are actually computers that we walk around with, are forced into obsolescence through two things working in tandem: hardware and software. Do you use a Windows computer? Have you received messages saying that if you don't upgrade to Windows 11, that your current computer will no longer receive support and protection from viruses and malware? Did you try to download Windows 11 to be told that your hardware is incompatible with Windows 11 and that you need to buy a new computer? Have the apps stopped working on your phone and now you need to upgrade phone because your phone will no longer support any of the apps that you are using? Do you use a Mac computer? Have you noticed that the performance of your Mac device gets worse with more and more updates, and that a suspicious amount of your Mac's storage is in this inaccessible area that you can't tell what's using up like 60 to 80% of your storage? Did you know that Windows has made a digital ID of you and everything you do on a computer, including things you do when you have a VPN active for your own security and privacy? Do you want to boycott them? Do you want to use your hardware as long as possible? Then it's time to learn about Linux and its distributions. Linux is an open source operating system that can be used in place of Windows or Mac. And because it is open source, many communities have freely made their own versions of Linux to cater to the diverse and different needs of computer users. For a long time, Linux had a reputation of being the computer geek's option, but the world of Linux-based operating systems has grown so that lay people like myself can make the switch. Are you savvy enough with technology to download something from the internet and then install it following instructions provided? Then why don't you give it a go and then offer to help the people in your life make the change too? Are you in a union working in the public sector? Some governments are abandoning Windows and Mac to protect their own digital security from these companies and their ties to the US government. Make this a union issue to move away from these corporate platforms. Our public privacy and protection is an issue of national security. Maybe this is the kind of technical service our libraries could be offering us too. Are Linux distributions safe to use? Yes, but some are more secure than others, and no operating system or computer out there is impervious to malware and viruses. So you still need to be mindful of how you navigate the internet and use your computer. But most people don't need the ones designed for maximum security and hacking. Most people need reliable and simple to use operating systems for basic daily use. Open source software is maintained by hundreds to thousands of people. Some of the Linux distributions do require some payment for the time and labor of the teams who maintain them, but the important thing is that you have many options out there. I will leave a link to a Wikipedia page, yes, another wonderful open source project that lists all the different Linux distributions out there, and I'm pretty sure there's even more than on the page, so incredible wealth of choice. But if this is all too overwhelming and you want to make the switch, then get that tech-savvy friend in your life to help. Now, this change alone should extend the usability and life of your device and vastly upgrade your digital privacy and security. But what about hardware? I would like to include in this segment what is becoming known as CyberDecks. These are self-built computers operating Linux distributions that are cheap, ethical, and personalized. Some people get retro TVs or retro computer keyboards and then plug their tiny computer into these things and carry them around in a suitcase. It's very cute, it's fun, and it's personalized to you without having to go through a major corporate producer or operating system. Check out the company that has led the way in these small, fun computer builds. They are fairly ethical, although there is no ethical consumption under capitalism, especially when it comes to computer technology. And this company, of course, I'm talking about is Raspberry Pi. It's pretty rare for a 3CR program to plug a company that sells you things, but it sets an important standard that many other companies and makers are following. So actually, this company does not have a monopoly on this market, and you can type Raspberry Pi-like companies into your search engine, and you will come across all the different companies out there that produce a similar product, some of which more catered to other types of users. One of the standards that they have set is transparency. Transparency about how they make the product and how long you can expect the hardware and software to last on your Raspberry Pi and be supported by the company. And it's a long time. It's longer than Mac and Windows, and the customability of the device means that you, depending on your needs, can extend the life of that tiny computer that fits in the palm of your hand for well over a decade to come. However, I'm not a user of these tiny computers. I think they're adorable, but I can't justify buying one when I already have a phone and a computer in my life? You know, I don't want to contribute to this consumption that is destroying the planet and awful conditions for people mining the materials for these devices across the globe. So I've gone down a different path, which is squeezing the most life out of my current devices. I always buy secondhand with my phone. I am happily many generations behind the current smartphones. I also use a wireless keyboard with my phone when I need to type emails and work on documents. I have a computer I bought secondhand years ago that sits under my TV. The TV is my computer monitor, and I surf the web on my computer to watch TV and films from whatever website or distributor I want without restrictions set by the manufacturer or of the TV or a device like Chromecast. I can run my favorite old computer games, and I can switch between different operating systems, like turning my computer into a retro gaming console by simply installing the retro gaming Linux-based operating system on an external hard drive, which gives me the ability to make my hardware deliver different things with one device. So where should you begin? Well, do you even need a computer? Would a library computer suit your needs? If you do need one, then ask yourself this question. What do I use computer technology for in my life? Is it emails, work, surfing the web, TV, gaming? Can your phone do everything you need? If not, then research how you can do that with your existing hardware or enlist the help of a more tech-savvy person in your life. Just tell them you wish to move away from the major corporate platforms and towards open-sourced platforms like Linux. One thing I will note is that our phones are a little trickier to change operating system with by design. Android phones use an operating system that is a Linux distribution, but obviously this is a corporate-controlled version. When I have done a little more experimenting with phones, I will be sure to make a future segment to give you some ideas. Thanks for listening to today's Cool Stuff segment that we don't use, but probably should.
The law is part of our everyday lives, including when we buy something, use a service, have a job, or rent a house. The law can be used to help protect and support families when there is violence in the home or disputes over parenting arrangements. Sometimes we might need to understand the law to navigate specific government systems like Centrelink, getting a residency visa, or if we come into contact with the police. Community legal centres provide free, quality legal advice and assistance to help people with everyday legal problems. We focus on working with people who are experiencing disadvantage, such as financial hardship, family violence, homelessness, and discrimination. Community legal centres are independent, non-government organisations and can be found across Victoria and Australia. If you're experiencing a legal problem, your local community legal centre may be able to help. To find a community legal centre near you, visit the Federation of Community Legal Centres Victoria at www.fclc.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
Welcome back. You're listening to 3CR Community Radio on 855 AM digitally or online at 3cr.org.au/listen or on the Community Radio Plus app. I'm Amy and you are listening to Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence. We are now going to turn to former 3CR program, The Sewer Show, on Rojava. It is a fantastic episode that I will leave a link to the full thing on this episode's webpage.
The Sewer Show.
Squatters and unwaged airwaves.
Presenting views, news and interviews from the Centrelink queues.
Information on your squatting, legal and other rights.
Troublemaking news from around the world.
Coming at you every Friday between 5:30 and 6:30 p.m. on 3CR.
Hi there, welcome to The Sewer Show. You're listening to 3CR, 855 AM on your dial, or you can go to 3cr.org.au if you want to stream live or listen to any of our podcasts. My name is Suze, and I'm here with Rick and Anissa. We're from Doing It Ourselves, a local activist group that focuses on raising awareness about the need for broad systemic change. We host The Sewer Show on the third Friday of every month, along with all the other sewer team. We want to discuss the need for systemic change from our current structures of oppression. And we aim to encourage resistance and raise awareness of alternatives against those oppressive structures because they do exist. So that's a little bit about us. But before we jump into the show, we just wanted to acknowledge the land that we're on. So today we want to talk about Rojava, which is also known as the Democratic Federation of Northern Syria. That's an autonomous region in the Middle East working to create a truly democratic society. Rojava, as it's still commonly known, is an incredibly inspiring alternative that role models potential ways of achieving revolution and cultural change towards more equitable, sustainable, and in fact joyful society. We want to give a little explanation of Rojava and the history and ideologies behind it, and then we're going to be playing some recordings that a member of our DIO sent us from the US, where they're actually studying Rojava as part of a postgraduate degree in anthropology and social change. The recordings are taken from some talks by a person named Havan Ganesa, who is a lifelong activist with the International Kurdish Freedom Movement. She's an engineer, journalist, and a women's rights activist. And we're very lucky to have access to Havan's words and send our gratitude across the oceans for the collaborative efforts of systemic change activists everywhere. It feels really exciting that we're working collectively to share stories of revolution to help inspire people and, of course, grow support for the fellow freedom fighters who are stuck in an embargoed zone surrounded by radical fundamentalists and nation forces actively working to dismantle their efforts. We're going to have a listen to Havan, and then we'll discuss the relevance of the Rojavan efforts to activism and culture change here in Australia. And, of course, we've always got a few radical songs peppered throughout.
So first, we're just going to talk a little bit about Rojava, or as since 2016, it's been known as the Democratic Federation of Northern Syria. So the region gained its autonomy first in 2012, which was part of the Syrian civil war. So you might have heard about all that with the Arab Spring. There's a lot going on. And so this gave the historically marginalized Kurds their first real chance to assert their autonomy and embark on a radical experiment in direct democracy. So Rojava refers to the Kurdish part of Syria, which in fact means west in Kurdish. And the rest of the Kurdish homelands are in Turkey, Iraq, and Iran. So if you look up on a map, you'll see that all of those countries intersect, and though that mountainous region is Kurdistan. But of course, you know, in the history of nation states, when they've drawn lines on the map, they haven't really thought about the people who are living there. And so the Kurdish people have been long oppressed in all of these different nation states and even beforehand. Mm. For example, people might remember during the Saddam Hussein regime in Iraq, there was a huge genocide of the Kurdish people. And in many of the states, the Kurdish people have been forbidden to speak their language, to teach their culture, even
practice religion.
Yeah. Yeah, and even in Turkey, it was illegal to say the words Kurdish, which was pretty insane. But then when we're talking about the northern part of Syria, so what a lot of people call Rojava, but is now the Democratic Federation for Northern Syria, a bit of a mouthful.
Which is why we might say Rojava every now and then, just for brevity.
So it's linked to the PKK, which is the Kurdish Workers' Party in Turkey. The Kurdish Workers' Party has been fighting for Kurdish independence since it formed in 1984. And some people might have heard of the PKK's leader, or one of the leaders, Abdullah Öcalan. When the PKK started, it was a Marxist-Leninist organization and it was fighting for an independent Kurdish state. But since then, and especially since Öcalan got imprisoned in 1999 and is still in prison, and has written a lot of amazing things in prison, so definitely look up his work.
And still a cultural leader from within prison,
yes,
which is pretty phenomenal.
But since he's been in prison, he's been writing a lot more, like moving away from this idea of the Kurdish independent state and Marxist-Leninist ideas in that, and been reading people and getting influence from people like Murray Bookchin. And so, they've been working on this idea of democratic confederalism, which is another mouthful. and so in Rojava, the democratic confederalism was established by the Democratic Union Party. Well, there's a lot of words, so I really would just encourage people to look up the history, because I'm sure what I'm saying now is it's a bit of a whirlwind. It's an incredible history. But at the moment, in the Democratic Federation of Northern Syria, the power is decentralized as much as they can. It's rising up from the village assemblies and communes to the legislative councils and commissions that run the economy, defense, and justice. At all levels of this governance, they work really, really hard to make sure ethnic and gender balance is there. So they make sure to have one man and one woman in all these positions of governance, which is really, really amazing. But enough of me trying to condense the amazing history of this part of the world. We're going to go to a recording of Havan Gusana. And, yeah, this is what our friend sent to us from across the seas. And it's amazing kind of talk of the history of critique and self-critique as part of the Kurdish independence movement. So enjoy.
Look at the Kurdish freedom movement's history very shortly through critique and self-critique. I think this is very important because we really need to understand a little bit the dialectic of how PKK actually continuously evolved and renewed itself. Because some people would like to think that all this change occurred because Öcalan was abducted, so he had to find a new idea, and this is what he did. No, this is not how it happened. Over the 45 years, as you know, we talked about the change in the world, and its influence on this movement. And of course, their own struggle bringing out new knowledge and new parts of the truth, you know. We were talking about it with Andre today, that, you know, because we are made to think of our world history in a very linear model, that we are either looking at, you know, the struggle of just the working class under capitalism, and we don't see the struggle of, let's say, colonized people or tribes and clans, not to, you know, so that they won't be sucked into the classical civilization, as important as the struggle of the working class or that of the woman, you know, and its resistance to be assimilated by this classical civilization. And we can't, and the fact that all these different struggles have actually exposed one part of truth, you know. And now what Öcalan is actually trying to do in his democratic, in his theory of democratic civilization and democratic modernity, is to bring all these together as the integral truth, as the whole truth, you know. So therefore, you know, at the beginning, they knew that all they had was critique, actually, at the beginning. You know, as I said, they began with saying Kurdistan is a colony. So what they did at the beginning was to be able to recover Kurdish people's truth, you know. I mean, I remember him saying, you know, like 95% we are struggling against the Kurds. It's only 5% against the Kurdish state. This is an immense reality because over so many years and so many different policies being implemented, you know, both ideological, physical, economical, you know, policies that Kurds themselves had distance themselves from their own reality. And it was so, so difficult to bring them back in. I remember him saying, you know, like, Vietnamese people, they knew they were Vietnamese, you know. But Kurds, you had to first say, hey, look, you know, you have another truth, you have something else here, you know. So therefore, to be able to do that, first what they did was to, through critique, they had to expose the official state ideology of Turkey, you know, and the methods they used. Because they used various methods, you know. Let's say some places they made extremely religious, you know, they actually actively did that. And some other places what they did was they paved the way so that city would go to university a lot, you know. So that, you know, if I'm, let's say, from Dersim, and I am from Dersim, you know, they would be mostly educated and they would look down upon the rest, you know. Although they were as much, you know, oppressed and exploited and etc., and they would be assimilated, you know. So they used all sorts of different methods and techniques. So first of all, you know, this was very important to be done. And of course, to be able to show what the infrastructures and superstructures of these methods were. But I think what was even more important, and this is also another way that the freedom movement did this, how they can be overcome. You know, not just to expose these, but also come up with creative means of how they can be overcome. So, in fact, the method was this. When you critiqued, you had to also show, if not that, what? So critiquing the other side of the medallion was to show what the new can be, what it is to be replaced with. So especially those early years was the development of the ideological and political capacity and ability of the movement through this dialectic of critiquing. But of course, what came up with that, as they critiqued this, you know, they saw that, I remember one of the you know, people who was present at the beginning, he had given an interview and he was saying that we would go to the villages and we would say, down with imperialism and colonizers. And we would go, nothing would come down, you know. You know, so although, yes, we critiqued and we talked about it and we did this, but we saw that by just talking, it wasn't coming down, you know. And so what had to follow, therefore, was practice of it and its implementation. So if I can just give years according to this now, from the group's birth to 1980s, the task, the very important and primary task, was to develop ideological critique. There is not much self-critique yet, because they are still trying to find themselves, who they are, you know, what they are going to represent, what they reject. And the reason was also very simple, because they had to break those boundaries in their heads first, right? I mean, I don't know, maybe some of you give tuitions or lessons. When one talks about something, one actually overcomes it itself in its own sense too. So all the other duties at the time were actually secondary. So in fact, therefore, what they did was to analyze the situation, critique it, and take the responsibility to do something about it. I think this dialectic to today is able to be the motor power of the Kurdish freedom movement. So there are, of course, many stages that they went through. You know, when they saw that, of course, when the critiquing was in 1980 almost over for that era of the freedom movement's developments, what they saw was that when they went out to implement it, not everybody was doing the same thing, you know. One had interpreted in one way, the other interpreted it another way. Therefore, what they understood was that this time they began to point the critique internally. So what they did during this time is to critique the Kurdish society from 1980, you know, 81, 82 onwards, but especially after 1985. The point of critiquing turned more inside than outside, both in terms of the Kurdish rebellions of the past. And PKK was very much criticized for this because they said, oh, how can you criticize the rebellion of whichever, you know. And also the Kurdish society and also themselves. So their implementation and practice. Because what they saw that two things were done, you know, some and... especially the more intellectuals or those, you know, coming from universities and stuff, they kind of had the idea, I will just tell the truth and the rest will just happen, you know, whoever's going to do that. So so that was one. And or others thought that there's no need for education, no need for expanding of knowledge. You know, we've made a decision, we'll just go and do it, and that's it. So, therefore, you know, there were a lot of these discussions to alleviate these problems. And they reached a conclusion, you know, in their own practice, that praxis cannot be severed from theory or ideology. So what they their main pillar became to be this, and Öcalan describes it as, you know, think as you do, do as you think. This is to be able to catch those moments of doing things differently, you know. Because usually we act and react in certain formats. You know, there is like, you know, if I come and, you know, slap you, you will just get up and slap me, you know. Maybe it's a very, you know, vulgar way of defining it, but... You know, if you come and slap me, I just slap me. I just think about it a little bit and, you know, do something else instead of that. Or you coming and slapping me, instead of doing that, you think about it. So therefore, this approach was implemented both on momentary doings, but also on, you know, practices of times, like 1 year, couple of months, or whatever. This was also, you know, this weapon of critique and self-critique, therefore, allow them to both clarify their position and develop their implementation.
Talking about the autonomous region of Syria, who have a bit of an anarchist model of self-direction, which is why we're really excited. So before that CSA, we listened to a chunk of a talk about the importance in Rojava about critique and self-critique. And that's so exciting because it gives this amazing insight into the lived experience of what it's like to actually create that sort of culture change and the like real deconstruction and then rebuilding of like a state and a people and a self, you know? It's so interesting. So I'm here with Anissa and Rick in the studio, and we just want to have a little chat about what we listened to.
Maybe I'll start with one of my... I thought the most interesting lines in what she said was that they were fighting 95% against the Kurds and 5% against, like, you know, against the state.
Mm.
And I thought that was really interesting, this idea that, you know, we are fighting against, like, oppressive institutions like the state and capitalism and corporations, but we're also fighting against ourselves and we're fighting against all the people. And so we need to have that culture change that we talk about it, doing it ourselves. Like, you need to change how people think, and only then will we get somewhere. And instead of just this idea of, oh, I need to make that company collapse and then we'll be sweet.
Yeah.
Because we won't be sweet unless we actually work out how to, you know, well, critique our society well and understand the problems in our society, but then we also critique ourselves and understand how we create those problems.
Mm. And that work takes ages. Like, you know, we've been doing this sort of work within Doing It Ourselves for a while, and obviously people work on this for a lifetime, you know.
Yeah.
We sort of, I feel excited to do this work in my life day to day, because kind of what they said, you know, your practice is inseparable from your ideology. So getting better at doing this sort of self-critique work in your day-to-day life, in your relationships, in your communities, helps us then to extrapolate it to the wider community as well. So why don't we just start now?
Well, and get better at, I mean, I think what I find frustrating in Australia and what often leads me to idealise places like Rojava is that it feels like our critique in Australia is not very strong. Even before we get to self-critique, our critique as a society, like we're barely in the mainstream, you know, environment movement, social justice movement. We're barely talking about capitalism. We're barely talking about patriarchy, where, you know, and which is really frustrating. And then we also have this inability to critique ourselves as movements.
Do you think it just gets taken verbatim? We know that capitalism is bad. We know patriarchy is bad. So we don't go into the in-depth of it because we feel like a sense of urgency to just tear it down. So we don't put the effort in.
Oh, well, I think even a conversation I was having the other day about the environment movement and how there was one of the largest, you know, groups in the environment movement refused to be part of a campaign because that campaign was explicitly anti-capitalist.
Mm.
And so that just kind of took me back to this place of, well, outside my bubble of friends and, like, fellow people that fight for social justice, most people out there don't question capitalism and don't question patriarchy.
I think there's, like, a cognitive dissonance, you know. I mean, we've talked about cognitive dissonance a lot and the sort of steps it takes to create behaviour change. Mm. I think there's a bit of a misnomer in, you know, activists or social justice movement that education is enough, that if we just sort of tell people, if we can just get them to see, you know, capitalism's bad or patriarchy's bad, but that's not actually where the behaviour change kicks in, you know. Mm. Education doesn't actually work. It's not necessarily the imperative. It's more sort of working it through with people, because then it can break through the cognitive dissonance and showing them how to live their life in an alternative way, and then I think the conversations can start happening a bit more. But that's just my perspective. I really think that, like, deconstruction, there's an amazing feminist critic and academic and intellectual who talks about Geriatry Spivak, by the way her name is, but she talks about deconstruction as the most intimate act that you can do. And I think that people don't like to look at capitalism, don't like to rock the boat. We don't like to be critical. We're conflict avoidant as a people. That's kind of like a colonialist construct, you know, walk away, don't create conflict. And that means that we're not actually going more in depth into these ideas. But to deconstruct something is not, you know, conflict. It's intimate. It's beautiful to do that with your fellow people and your communities. God, it's beautiful.
I was thinking about how there's like customs where you don't bring up stuff at dinner parties or something like that. And it's a bit more of a traditional idea. You're like a family dinner or something, and you wouldn't bring up anything that anyone could disagree about, anything contentious. And it's just
Christmas
so weird.
Is like that.
It's really hard for me to imagine not talking about stuff that you could, I don't know, have a difference in opinion about. Like, what does that leave? So if you've got that going on culturally, it's pretty hard to talk about anything that might be a bit hard to swallow or create a bit of an awkward space, because this stuff is kind of awkward to talk about, especially if people are getting onto this early on and, you know, getting their head around this stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that brings up one of the big differences between Australia and, like, the Democratic Federation of Northern Syria, is that we're so much more comfortable. And so you can live your entire life going to your family gatherings and, you talk about your work and, you know, there are obviously conflicts that are going to come up, especially, that, you know, in disagreements, but it's because most people in Australia are so much more comfortable and there's not, you know, at least not yet, hectic repression for the majority of Australians. That definitely is for some parts of the Australian populace. But, whereas when you're over in a country and, you know, ISIS is coming and knocking on your door and they are such a patriarchal, like, you know, extremist, violent group of people and they are coming at your door with guns, like...
There's no choice.
Exactly. And you kind of... you have to do something.
Yeah.
And this amazing idea that they've spent so much time as a people deciding, well, this is actually really important and we need to spend time doing it and talking about it.
The revolution in Rojava is a beacon of hope for the world, putting direct democracy and feminism into practice on a broad scale. This radical attempt at social transformation now faces huge challenges, including daily attacks by the Turkish military with little outside recognition or aid. Show your support for Rojava by joining Northeast Syria Solidarity, or NESS, and help ensure the survival of this inspiring experiment in social change. NESS sends aid, raises awareness, and builds solidarity. Get involved at www.nesssolidarity.org.au. NESS is a 3CR supporter.
Do you care about older people's housing? Are you keen to talk to politicians and your community about why housing for older people is important?
Then become a housing champion with Housing for the Age Action Group. The Housing Champions program will train older people to talk about housing leading up to the Victorian election in November this year. For more information and to register your interest, go to Housing for the Age Action Group's website, oldertenants.org.au, or call us on 03 9654 7389.
A 3CR supporter.
And we're just taking a break here. You're listening to Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence. I am playing former great show, The Sewer Show, with Suze, Anissa and Rick, talking all about Rojava and how Rojava can be great inspiration for us here in so-called Australia on living and doing things differently.
It's mind-blowing, honestly. My brain tingles at it. And I love the way that it's paired with a discussion of alternatives, you know, like the necessary critique combined with, like, being productive and helping revision their cultural frameworks. That is really special. I think that's one of the reasons why conflict feels so hard, because we get stymied in the actual that initial conversation rather than moving to a more progressive place of, like, okay, where to now?
Yeah.
You know, first you've got to understand what you're going through and that's when you can break through. So, like, yeah, that dialogue that they've got going on there between, like, that critique but then also breaking down the boundaries and re-sort of visioning their culture and self and identity as a people, it's amazing work. Like, that's revolutionary.
Yeah. Yeah, and what you were saying before, they do it while thinking about it. Like, what was it? Do as you think and think as you do.
Yeah.
Like, that really important. And that, I think, is another thing that we struggle with in Australia is, you know, the armchair socialist kind of intellectual. And I just loved one line that she said about how, oh, you go and you, you know, yell about the system or yell about the corporation and yell how it should fall down. And, oh, it didn't fall down. It's just like, Yeah, of course it didn't. You need to be, you know, doing.
When she says that praxis cannot be separated from ideology, like, praxis is a bit of a jargon, cerebral word, but it's just like living your change, you know, like actively implementing it day to day. And I think a lot of people, you know, because of what you say about Australia's a lucky country, we're not attached to that resistance work, you know.
Yeah.
So it's not an imperative that praxis exists in our day-to-day life unless you're an oppressed person.
Totally. Yeah. And and that makes you think of the amazing Indigenous resistance in Australia.
Totally.
And the parallels are infinite in how, you know, they talk about that every day is a fight.
Yep.
And it's like, well, yeah, so therefore, you know, there's so much more imperative to create this amazing resistance and, like, visioning and celebrate culture as resistance.
Just thought popped into my head then of just like the disparate sort of demographics of Australia. It's such a huge country. It's really hard for us to, you know, work together. Like, I'm thinking that that's why it's a bit easier in northern Syria, because it's just literally such a small location. They can door knock, and they do door knock. They go around and, you know, tell women, telling other women, there's safe spaces for you to come to. We want you. We value your voice. And it encourages that, you know. So we're just so spread out here that it's actually hard to create.
Well, we can afford to not have community.
Yeah, true. Oh, is that capitalism helping not create community? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Well, it's like it'll be kind of uncomfortable and unsatisfying, but not dire enough to kind of goad you into radically doing something. So you can just kind of coast along and live your
life. In you can just order Uber.
Exactly. You can outsource it.
Uber Eats every night after work. Yeah. And you have no need to rely on your neighbours.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, I find it awkward to go and ask my neighbours for something, because now culturally it's kind of different. And as much as you can yearn for a time where, oh, we can go and talk to your neighbour and ask him for something. Like, it kind of feels awkward doing that, because they're sort of out of that, and it takes effort to get almost back to that, which is...
That's a classist thing, though, as well, this idea of like, oh, I don't want to look poor. I don't want to be seen to be not achieving or succeeding. Therefore, I'm alienated from that connection, which is so interesting. And I remember some research I came across doing a cooperative work that I did a few years ago that said that people actually aren't inclined to come and ask. We really suck at asking, hence needing to practice the ask, you know. But people are likely to engage when others start engaging them. So, like, if you receive a gift, you're more likely to want to engage in community. I'm intrigued to, you know, look at Rojava in that respect. Like, how did they jumpstart that? You know?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think it probably just comes back to the necessity. The necessity. And, like, unfortunately, part of the talk that we cut out, because we can't, I mean...
There's so much. It's so juicy, exactly. Guys.
It's an hour and a half long. So you can message us at Doing It Ourselves Facebook and we can send it through to you. But the first big chunk was going into the incredible history of the Middle Eastern region, and how, like, the Kurdish people have existed in that history of constant, like, you know, genocide and, you know, different groups oppressing other groups. And so there's just a much stronger history of resistance.
Yeah.
And that, you'd imagine hopefully it's talked about more than it's talked about here. I feel like in Australia we just want to pretend like we've always been here, hanging out, being like British people. It's always been like this. There is no history before white people came here.
Gloss over.
Yeah, exactly.
I'd quickly say this. Like, I was at the Shrine of Remembrance, and it's made with these columns, and it's all sort of ancient looking. Like, as though it was built 5,000 years ago or something. It creates this sort of fake mythic vibe, you know?
There is that fake myth of Australia, isn't there? There really is. The, like, it's the lucky country, the go-getter, the, rapscallion.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm intrigued as to, like, what practices of self-critique we could start that people do in their day-to-day life, and how, like... as an example to jumpstart us a little bit, perhaps I could talk to the way that Doing It Ourselves started a couple of years ago, doing sort of self-reflective practice before we had meetings, you know, which we had quite regularly. And we'd talk about hierarchies, and we'd talk about how we were feeling. But essentially we were just putting effort into deconstructing and critiquing ourselves and how we functioned, and that was like a real imperative. That's how we started every meeting. And that just created a culture so beautifully around that sort of self-critique in like an easy way. Didn't feel confronting, at least not to me. Did it to you?
No. I think just going around a circle and just checking in how people are feeling about the hierarchies in the group. And as soon as, you know, one person kind of, you know, says something about someone and they take it really well, or they say something about themselves being like, you know, I feel like I've been taking up too much space, then it creates so much trust. And I think also as a group, we've spent a lot of time talking about our shared theory of change.
Yep.
And that creates a lot of trust and understanding, which, I don't think happens. I'm not sure how many groups have spent, you know, hours and hours and hours, talking about how they want to change the world and what sort of world they want to see and how to do that and critiquing each other's ideas. To me, that's just such important work that's not really happening. Well, I wish it was happening a lot more.
Totally. We'd like to hear about it more.
which I absolutely love, and I think it segues really nicely from our conversation before when we're talking about the, yeah, we need to be sitting around and having these conversations and working on our theory of change and practicing critiquing, like how we're going to critique the current issues in our society, but also how we're going to critique ourselves as we're doing the work that needs to be done. But that needs a lot of time. And one of the most difficult things in Australia that I find is a lot of people, oh, but I have to go to work. I have to go to uni. And so this is talking about the importance of meetings and how they look at meetings in this Kurdish region of northern Syria.
How many hours a week on average are Kurdish radicals spending in meetings? Seriously, I mean that seriously.
No, you're right.
Because I'll tell you something, there is no culture of hanging out at political meetings left in the Bay Area, hardly at all. Mm. It's in low ebb and has been for ebbing lower and lower over time. Mm-hmm. And I think it's part of the technological world we're living in and the fact that everybody's this huge, massive speed up and everybody's too busy and everybody's working all the time and paying ridiculous rents, et cetera. So I'm just kind of really curious about, you know, the practical reality starting in this epic break in 2005, and you talked about it as a line or a sort of philosophical guide, you know, kind of parameters were arrived at through collective discussion. How, in reality, how many hours per week do people spend doing that, and how did that actually work? Because it's hard for me to imagine having enough time to sit around with a bunch of people to come to those kind of conclusions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you know, if we look at one of the other things, what the capitalist system did is to hijack our time. You know, when we look at other forms of state, you know, we see that if you go just to the Roman Empire, you know, I had a look at, you know, what kind of holiday periods they had. Half of the year are holidays. No, really. And but what is being given to us in this system is if you don't work, you're a bum, you know, you're a bum, and that everybody should work, and therefore, you know, our holiday times have been reduced and reduced and reduced, you know. And so, like in the past, of course, it's part of this consumption culture, you know, but it's also not to leave time for you to think or do anything, you know, constructive. Well, they would call it destructive, maybe, you know. Like, you know, in the past, let's say, if a shoemaker makes a shoe, you know, you'll just go to him and say, okay, I want a shoe, and him or her, and, you know, come back in a week. And he can do it or she can do it in a day or two or in a week. But now, you know, people have to work nonstop to make shoes, to make this, to make that. And we have to work nonstop to consume them, you know. So you're right, you know. And so what happens is that meetings become cumbersome, you know. Talking becomes a burden, you know. Like the real things that people should be doing become the unnecessary things, because we are made to think and feel that it's easier if somebody else decides for us. So much easier. You don't have the responsibility. But we will, you know, critique if they are not doing the right thing, you know. So we are being reduced to that. And I really want to talk about this probably tomorrow and the third day as well, you know. How, and we, Öcalan calls this society side. Society side, and we will delve more into that. We were in Rojava, I think about 3 months ago, and then I heard a story there, and it was just so, so funny. Two people are getting married, and they ask the woman, you know, do you like him? Do you love him? And then she turns around and says to him, I love you like the, you know, PKK cadres or the apogees love their meetings. You know, and it's exactly what you've been asking. And it's not just the cadres.
And you were just listening to the former 3CR show, The Sewer Show, with Suze, Anissa and Rick. That's all we have time for this week. You can listen back to this episode and other episodes by heading to 3cr.org.au/Kill Your Lawn or on your favourite but evil podcasting platform. Stay tuned to Think Again, and next week we will be visiting the suburb of Armstrong Creek and how it is an example of modern suburban hellscapes that is rapidly occurring across so-called Australia.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.